Welcome to WISA Weekend, WISA's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks for joining us this Sunday morning. Coming up on today's program, WISA Curious and information on this year's Concours d'Elegance at Carillon Park. Up first, there is an effort underway in the village of Yellow Springs to make it a dementia-friendly community. The Yellow Springs Senior Center, the Greene County Council on Aging, the Alzheimer's Association, and other groups are working together on the project. And to tell us what it means to be a dementia-friendly community, here's Toni Dosick. She is the project director for Dementia-Friendly Yellow Springs.
It really started with Karen Wolford, who's the director of the Yellow Springs Senior Center. And from time to time, they would get calls from businesses or people in the community or a retail store and say that somebody had come into the store, into the bank, and seemed confused and couldn't remember why they were there. And somebody would call the senior center. They would go down and talk to them. And that happened numerous times. And simultaneously, Karen heard about a large organization called Dementia Friendly America that's working across the entire United States to help communities, small villages, large cities, to become more friendly and more accessible to people who have dementia and cognitive difficulties. She quickly realized that this was an opportunity for Yellow Springs. She saw the need from the senior center's experience, and the population of Yellow Springs has been aging steadily. And by 2020, 45% of people living in Yellow Springs are going to be over the age of 65. It's a trend that's been going on for 20 years. So not that dementia or Alzheimer's disease, it's actually decreasing overall, but because we will have a high concentration of people over 65, it's actually probably going to increase here in Yellow Springs. So she came up with a proposal, sent some applications, got funding from the Del Mar Social Fund, from the Dayton Foundation and the Yellow Springs Community Foundation. And basically the program it's 18 months. That clock has started. It's really about training people in the community, first responders, owners of businesses, people in the faith community, people who are involved in retail, wherever people encounter members of the community, to train them on how to be responsive to somebody when they walk into their bank and they can't remember why they're there. It's not a complicated training. We're very lucky that we have really great partners with the Greene County Council on Aging and the Alzheimer's Association. So we have professionals who do this training. I'm the project director. I work with Kate LeVacant, who's the coordinator of the project. Neither one of us have particular experience in dementia, but we've got these wonderful partners who are professionals in the field. So the first event is coming right up, September 15th at 8:30 in the morning, breakfast, a healthy breakfast provided by Friends Care. And it'll be at the Senior Center. And it's basically the kickoff, just in the morning, so that we hope business people and store owners and people will be able to attend before they start their day. And we'll talk a little bit about what's planned. The training will start probably in the new year. We're very flexible. The training could start any time for any sector that wants it. And it'll give us an opportunity to talk to people about what's coming up, recruit some additional people to our advisory committee so that we're more aware and cognizant of the needs of the people who are either caregivers of family or friends with dementia or themselves have some form of dementia. We want to be very responsive to that community. And so we're forming an advisory committee to help us do that.
WISO has recently been involved with the Disabilities Project, and one thing that was mentioned to us is by making first responders aware of what takes place with people with mental disabilities, especially in light of today's opioid and drug use, that early communication and awareness for first responders is increasingly important.
Yes. In fact, when we met with Colin Altman about a week and a half ago, and he was very enthusiastic about this, as has the police chief. I think, you know, especially in a small community like Yellow Springs, thankfully, where we don't have much major crime, many of the calls that they get are for people who are anxious or having some kind of concerns, whether it's a mental illness or their cognitive function is impaired and they're scared or they're anxious about something. And they were they're very interested in this training because they know that it's going to help their staff respond appropriately. It's going to help things from getting more escalated than they might otherwise. People with dementia get anxious and frustrated when they can't be understood, and sometimes that gets things a little bit more excited than they need to be. So, again, doing this training helps people to be comfortable both with dementia and people working or encountering somebody with dementia to not find it scary or not find it strange. And Yellow Springs is famous for being a very welcoming community. We're known, I think, a little bit for our eccentricity. So I think this is a project that I think fits right into the ethos of this community and something that would be, I think, very welcomed.
And on the path to increasing awareness about this, you also have, there's a conference that takes place in October. Let's talk a little bit about the workshops that will be offered there.
That is a conference that the Yellow Springs Senior Center runs every year. This is their second one, and I assume they'll have more going on. And the conference is a full day. Its focus is for both information and workshops for professionals in the field as well as lay people. So we have the keynote speaker is Larry Lorhorn, who is a professor at Wright State, the Bunshoff Medical School. We have presentations for professionals about understanding some of the newer research in dementia. We have presentations about working with people who have dementia. And so it sort of has these two tracks for both professionals in the field, and because of that, they're able to get continuing education credits. And for lay people who want to know more about dementia, Alzheimer's disease, and in general. And that, it's October 12th, and it's at Antioch University Midwest, right outside of the village across the street from the high school. And that needs registration. People are interested. It's quite easy to register, or they could email me, or they could email Kate, either one of us, and we can help them register.
And how many people are involved in this project? In your role as project director, how many people are you working with to
roll
this
out? Well, it's basically myself and Kate. And then we have these wonderful partners with the expertise. Karen Puderball, particularly from Green County Council on Aging, she has been very, very instrumental in helping to set up the conference, getting the speakers, organizing the workshops. So that's been really great. Again, the Wright State University Medical School has been wonderful. One of the first people we met with was the chair of the geriatrics department there, Daniel Swaggerty, and he was very enthusiastic, as has everyone. One of the things that was interesting is, again, in the early stages, Kate and I went up to Findlay, Ohio, which is the other community in Ohio that developed a dementia-friendly program. And that was really enlightening to see how something actually took place and what a long-standing impact it had on the community. The program officially ended in 2013, but they're still doing outreach. They're still receiving referrals. People are still inquiring about help. So it had a big impact and a long-lasting impact, and that's something that we hope will happen here too.
Dementia-Friendly Yellow Springs, we're speaking with Tony Dosick, who is the project director. And again, that's the kickoff breakfast on Friday, September 15th at the Yellow Springs Senior Center, and the conference that takes place at Antioch University Midwest in October. October 12th is that date. Where can folks find out more information about both of these?
Well, they can find out more about the September 15th by emailing me is the best way, or go on the Senior Center website, the Yellow Springs Senior Center website, and they can find out also about the conference in October on the Yellow Springs Senior Center website.
Tony Dosick, who is Project Director for Dementia Friendly Yellow Springs. We'll have links to those email addresses up on our website. And thanks for your time today.
Thank you. Thank you. I enjoyed it. Thanks.
Today on Why So Curious, Community Voices producer Jonathan Platt takes a trip to Fairborn, Ohio in northwest Greene County for a quick history lesson about how the town got its name.
There is only one Fairborn in the United States, and it is right here in Greene County. But that is not as bizarre as the history of how it got its name. Fairborn is the conflation of two different town names, Fairfield and Osborne. How the fair and the born eventually merged together takes some explanation. To begin with, I visited the Fairborn Historical Society at their meeting at the local senior center. Events coordinator Marty Riddle spreads out pictures of Victorian homes that appear to be on wheels.
This house is Harry Frond's house. It shows it being pulled by the tractor. This was an advertisement in the newspaper, we found out. It says the town that packed up and moved, destined to become one of the leading cities of the Miami Valley.
Unfortunately, Osborne did not become a town of distinction and recognition in the Miami Valley. But very few towns have moved house by house to another location. After the Dayton flood of 1913, the Army Corps of Engineers built a series of dams around the Miami Valley. Unfortunately for Osborne, the Huffman Dam was being built nearby, and the town was now in the floodplain. So the Army Corps of Engineers condemned Osborne and ordered the occupants to vacate the area. But instead of leaving, the Osborne residents decided that they liked their town so much, they would just move it. Many business leaders and community officials, including the mayor of Osborne, were responsible for moving over 300 houses, a church, and a hardware store on wheels to the neighboring town of Fairfield between 1917 and 1926. Community leaders created the Osborne Moving Company, and a special rigging crew from Iowa helped with the endeavor. A team of horses pulled the houses from the foundation, and tractors did the mile-and-a-half tow down 235 to Fairfield.
Where are we? Standing in the parking lot in front of Skyborne Skateland, and right next to us is the Skyborne Theater, and right where we are today is where the old Osborne site was.
That's 25-year-old Fairborn historian Ryan Riffle, and we are standing just north of State Route 235 on Haddocks Road near the banks of the Mad River.
So this is how you enter the city of Osborne with your horse and buggy.
Correct.
Right here at the alley. We're standing right here on the alley entrance.
And they would have alleyways behind all the yards, because back then you had horse and buggy, so you had a barn, you kept your buggy in there. Osborne had a lot of those.
Nearly six football fields long, it is hard to imagine this windy prairie was once aligned with rows of alleyways and streets, large Victorian homes, five churches, a downtown with dozens of businesses that included a manufacturer of the buggy whip. After a quick drive back to New Osborne, or known presently as downtown Fairborn, I met with Mary Pacenda, another member from the Fairborn Historical Society. We stood in front of the public library on the corner of Central and Main. There you can see the houses that once made the town of Osborne.
But I wonder how many people think it's odd that in the middle of Fairborn, which is basically a blue-collar town, there's all these humongous houses in this general area here. Mm-hmm. How come? Where did they come from? Who had the money to build them? They don't fit with the rest of the basic town, this part of town.
And Osborne and Fairfield remained side by side for 30 years before they merged into the name Fairborn.
And there never was much love between the two cities. If you've ever moved into a small town, you're always a stranger. And that's the way Osborne was to Fairfield. And it was a stranger that moved into town. So they were none too happy when the merger happened. Osborne had more votes, and they were able to force the issue. And I can remember when I was working for the post office here in Fairborn in 1968, somewhere around there, almost 20 years afterward, there was still animosity between the two towns and a lot of resentment from the old Fairfield people.
The Osborne-Fairfield rivalry appears to have abated, with a morphed town, Fairborn, taking its place. But historians are making sure the story remains accessible and relevant. The National Park Service just received a grant to preserve the land where old Osborne sat. And the Air Force is providing state-of-the-art survey technology to get a clear understanding of what still remains in the lost town of Osborne. For Why So Curious, this is Jonathan Platt.
Why So Curious is sponsored by Proto Build Bar, proud supporter of Curious Minds. I'm Jerry Kenny. This is Why So Weekend. The Concord Elegance is Dayton history's largest fundraiser of the year. The annual event brings in antique automobile owners from near and far. Up next on Why So Weekend, we spoke with just two of the people involved in organizing and promoting the event. Skip Peterson is the board chair for Concours, while Lauren Bailiff is the director of community development at Dayton History. In our interview, we talk about highlights from this year's event.
It's one of the largest fundraisers for Dayton history, and all the proceeds from this event go there. But it's an invitation-only antique classic car and motorcycle show, showing vehicles from 1904 up through 1995. Most of the cars are 25 years and older, and they're restored to as original condition. Unique collector cars that you won't see. This is not a cruise-in. They don't show up in the morning. They nominate their cars. We have a car selection committee that reviews the entry. Is it worthy enough to be shown? So it's a notch above a regular car show, but it's also a family-friendly event. This is not a Concours d'Elegance like Pebble Beach, where all the judges wear a coat and tie. We're a Midwestern regional event, and we're family-friendly in all terms.
You mentioned that this is an invitation-only event. What do you need for an invitation, one of these cars?
Well, yes, you do. And there's plenty of cars around the area. And we actually draw cars from eight states this year. And as we get bigger each year, a car owner goes home and tells a buddy, you ought to go to this show. And so word of mouth is a very big thing in the automotive circles. But you can nominate your car. You can go to our website, fill out all the information about your car, and close a couple of photos. And that's really how it works. And then we have people that we learn that they've got a new 1935 Piercera they just added to their collection, and we invite them to bring it.
And you've been with this event since the beginning. Tell us how it started and how it may have changed over the years.
There was a previous Concours d'Elegance at another location in Dayton that I was involved with, and that kind of fell apart. And a number of us on that committee wanted to continue the event, and I suggested that we would hold it at Carillon Park because the tremendous automotive history in this town and everything this park does, it makes sense you want old cars in a place that celebrates everything else that makes Dayton historic. So.
And, Lauren, I'm sure you agree that, as Skip said, this is the perfect place for the Concours here at Dayton History.
Yes, it's a wonderful addition to the park landscape, and seeing all the cars nestled in between the historic buildings give it a really great effect. It's different than being in an open lawn or a golf course, and we just love to include those elements of history in the existing environment that we have here at the park. It's a wonderful, wonderful connection.
So the event takes place out back here rather than out on the lawn by the bells?
Right, that's correct. It takes place back in the historic landscape, back in the park area. We do have quite a bit of parking up front by the bell tower, so we use all the space that we have here.
What kind of crowd does this bring in?
Last year we saw our biggest crowd yet, and we saw about 6,000 attendees. And it's a very short time frame that we're working in there to get all those people in the door and get them to see the show. And there's a great deal of coverage there, so we are excited to bring 6,000 people and hope we can continue to increase our numbers. And this year should be a great year for it.
6,000 people, and how many cars are on display?
We have about 200 cars, and then we also have almost 40 historic and antique motorcycles that we add to the show as well.
Just a quick question on logistics. How much time does it take to load these cars in and get displays set up?
We spend all day Thursday, Friday, and Saturday getting things ready. the crew, and it's a volunteer staff of a volunteer crew of over 100 people. We're here at the crack of dawn on Sunday morning. At 8 o'clock, the cars start rolling in, and literally between 8 and 10, it goes from an empty park to 230 vehicles on display and ready to go. So it moves very quickly. It's kind of exciting. One of the things you should know this year, we're honoring the 50th anniversary of the Chevy Camaro as one of our featured classes. And we're also doing the evolution of the MG sports car, which is really the British sports car that brought sports cars to America. So we have four terrific classes of those cars. But we also came up with this idea. Mike Edgerton, our Concours director, and Alex Heckman, who's the education director here, were kicking around the idea of the cars of Orville Wright. Well, we found out that Orville was kind of a car guy, too, in addition to flying. And so we've assembled the number of cars that he was associated with or owned throughout his life. We've researched them. We have a 1904 St. Louis, which is the first car he ever drove, we believe. A 1910 Speedwell, which was manufactured in Dayton. And at one time, the Wright brothers were renting space at the Speedwell factory to build their airplanes before their factory opened. And he also had a 1932 Essex Terraplane. His last car was a Hudson. So we have actually found five examples that are similar cars to the ones he had, and they're going to be on display here. And it's taken off a little life of its own. When we cooked up the idea, a couple of us went, how are you going to find those? And surprisingly, you ask some questions and you find them.
Other highlights for the event this year?
Well, one of the things I think you should know about the event is every exhibit at the park is open. Interpreters are on hand. This is not just Dad's going to go to a car show today. Let's bring everyone. We have live entertainment. We have food vendors, so there's food available. At 12 o'clock, the Wright B Flyer, weather permitting, will make two passes over the park. They've done that for the last 4 years for us. So this is a family event where you can all come and everybody can do all kinds of things. And in the meantime, you can see cars like a 1906 Dayton motorbike that was built at the Davis Sewing Machine Company on Linden Avenue. We have one of those that's going to be here this year. A 1910 Hupmobile, a 1930 Packard Boat Tail Speedster. It's a rolling work of art. It really is. You're going to see a 1930 MG Midget with a canvas body. Years ago, some of them built the wood frame for the body and just covered it with canvas or leather. So we've got one of those coming. A 1952 Allard. Most people have never seen an Allard. There's probably only 35 or 40 of them in the United States. So things like that. You're going to see cars that you don't normally see every day. So pretty much there's some wow factor. And if you like cars in any way, shape, or form, I'm sure you'll find something you really like. We also are going to have the Fisher's Body Craftsman's Guild. Was a competition for teenage and college-age young men and women in the 50s to design cars of the future. It was GM's way of encouraging young people to become designers. We're holding a reunion of these guys. The guild no longer exists, but the fellows who participated, they get together once a year. We have one coming from California this year, bringing four of his models from the 50s. We have one coming from Maine, one from Minnesota, and two from Florida. And, I mean, it's unheard of. So there's all kinds of things going on within the Concours. So we pack a lot of activity in a six-hour time period.
Lauren, let's tell people how to find out more information about this event.
Sure. So if you want to be a part of the Dayton Concours d'Elegance or the Cars and Coffee event that happens on Saturday morning, that's a great draw as well. All of the information you can find out on DaytonConcours.com, and that's DaytonConcours.com.
We're also on Facebook at Dayton Concours d'Elegance. There's Saturday night, we have a preview party, which is we'll probably have 40 or 50 of the Concours cars on display. That's open to the public. You can find information about that at our website also. And then Sunday, the Concours open from 10:30 to 4. Parking is free. And get here early because by 3 o'clock, we're doing the awards ceremony.
Good luck with this year's event. Skip and Lauren, thanks so much for your time.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Bill Felker with Poorwell's Almanac for the fifth week of late summer, the second week of the cricket and the katydid moon. In this fifth week of late summer, the final tier of wildflowers starts to open. White and violet asters, orange beggar ticks, burr marigolds, tall goldenrod, zigzag goldenrod, and Japanese knotweed all come into bloom, blending with the brightest of the purple ironweed and the yellow sundrops and the blue chicory and the golden touch-me-nots and showy coneflowers and great lulabelia. Deep in the woods, the late wildflowers of this year coincide with the first growth of second spring, actually the first days of next spring. March's henbit comes up in the garden and wood mint puts out new stalks. Watercress revives in the sloughs. Next May's sweet rockets and next July's avens send up fresh basil leaves. Scattered flower and sweet Sicily sends out its foliage again. Sedum reappears, lanky from its canopied summer. On the farm, pickle season is usually over and peaches can be done for the year. Grapes are about to come in and elderberries are deep purple and sweet for picking. Nearly half of the tobacco has usually been cut, half of the commercial tomatoes have been picked, and about a fourth of the potatoes dug. Hickory nutting season opens as sweet corn time winds down. Burrs from the tick trefoil stick to your stockings when you wander off the trails. Lizard's tail drops its leaves into the creeks and sloughs. Beside the deer paths of the forest, the undergrowth is tattered and cluttered with the remnants of the year. The last fireflies are flickering. Red-headed woodpeckers, red-winged blackbirds, house wrens, scarlet tanagers, indigo buntings, eastern bluebirds, and black ducks are migrating. This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac. I'll be back again next week with notes for the first week of early fall. In the meantime, look for the signs of second spring, prophecy of the year ahead.
Bill Felker contributes to newspapers nationwide, including the Yellow Springs News. Bill resides in Yellow Springs. Poor Will's Almanac is also available as a podcast at WYSO.org.
And before we leave you, just a reminder that tonight at Riverscape Metro Park, join WYSO and local peace organizations for a day of music and community. From 4 to 6 p.m., it's the Miami Valley Peace Builders Walk, promoting peace literacy, the art of living peaceably. Then from 6 to 9, it's the WYSO Community Concert. This free, family-friendly concert will be headlined by Cincinnati's fabulous The Almighty Get Down. Other acts include Dayton's own Zane and the Sway, and the demented piano blues meets rockabilly sounds of the Claudettes from Chicago. We'll have food from the Wicked Witch of Dayton and Pa's Pork, beer from Yellow Springs Brewery, including the return of Vox Populi, Voice of the People, a community-minded American pale ale inspired by WYSO. Bring a chair and we'll see you there. Special thanks to our presenting sponsor, the Rotary Club of Dayton Peace Committee, and additional sponsors Wagner Subaru and United Rehabilitation Services. To take us out, here's music from the Claudettes. Thank you.
Music from the Claudettes, just one of the bands playing tonight at the Wiseau Community Concert. The information is on our website. We hope to see you there. Up next, Vic McCunis with the Book Nook.